You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today, we've got a pretty fun one for you. It's on our coding styles. We're going to go through all different coding styles of JavaScript and CSS and how do you write things. We'll do the silly ones, tabs and spaces, but we'll also get into a lot more rems, ems, and pixels. How do you make something 100% height? What is your approach to making HTML with JavaScript? Some pretty cool stuff. And Scott and I will go back and forth and sort of explain our approach and our thoughts behind all of this. We are sponsored by three awesome companies: FreshBooks, Cloud Accounting, Sentry, Error Exception Performance Tracking, and Sanity. They are the content platform for your next website. Check them out, and we'll talk about them partway through the episode. How are you doing today, Mr. Tolinsky?
Oh, I'm doing good. Yeah, I got nothing to report. This is like the sixth episode we've recorded today. So yeah, you know everything that I've been doing.
We are recording a whole bunch trying to get ahead. I'm about to move, so we're trying to get at least a couple weeks ahead so we can take some time off and work on the house a little bit. So excited about that.
Yeah, that is really super exciting. I am pumped for you, especially to see what you make of your new space. I think that's going to be really cool.
Yeah, it should be pretty fun. There's a lot of work to do in my office. I have to build an entire office, but I think it's going to be so sick by the end of it. So stay tuned for that. We'll have some shows on it.
So sick.
Let's jump right into it. Should we start with the JavaScript focus stuff and then get into CSS after that?
Sounds good to me.
All right, you kick it off there.
Okay, so functional versus object oriented. I find myself programming almost entirely functionally, where I'm not using classes, I'm not using even like classic JavaScript objects based OOP or anything like that. And I'm just, I for some reason, it makes it easier for me. I think the biggest thing for me that makes me want to type more in a functional manner is testing specifically. It feels way nicer for me to just test a single function, right? Single input, single output, test it, make sure it works. And to me, that was like the killer feature, was just how easier my code felt to test. So I primarily code functionally.
Yeah, me too. I would say 90% of the code that I write is functional. Every now and then I'll dip into object-oriented stuff, especially in my tutorials, is I don't want to, I do lean a little bit in the functional direction, but I do like to show people object-oriented as well, especially because people that are taking my tutorials are sometimes coming from an object-oriented language. Like I had one the other day where I needed to have a timer and I needed to be able to start and stop and pause that timer. And I was like, this is a pretty good use for a class, because you create a new class, you create a new timer. That timer can have like intervals in it. So it ran every however many seconds. And then I needed to pause that whenever I wanted it. So I just had a timer and it returned a new timer. I could run the stop, the start, and the pause methods right on top of it. But past that, especially when you get into these frameworks that are pretty functional as well, I tend to lean towards functional. I find it much easier to test.
Yeah, that's really it for me. What about in TypeScript, interfaces versus types? I've primarily been writing types, but now I think I have moved over entirely to interfaces just because of the more functionality it feels like you get with interfaces, whether that's extending them or if it just feels like they're easier to work about in. Like I had to create a bunch of like utility types to spread types and do all sorts of stuff that I wouldn't have to do with interfaces.
It's hilarious that you say that, because I was on interfaces by default and type when you need it. And as I've been building my TypeScript course, I've been kind of been like, well, a type would work. And I have a really good video of like the tiny little edge cases here and there that they, one's better than another. But I was like, oh, well, types make sense for a lot of the use cases as well. So I used to default to interface and then use a type when I need it. And that is the recommendation from TypeScript themselves. Mm. But then I find myself saying like, well, if I want to do like a custom alias or something like that, I do a type. And So I don't know where I'm at with that right now. I've just kind of been going back and forth between them, and not because I'm wishy-washy, but because I want to show people that you can do it in either way. But the maybe when we did the first TypeScript show, I am less confident on my answer of interface first. People said that interfaces are faster to compile. I don't know necessarily know if that's a reason why you should use interface over type, but if that says anything, it means it doesn't matter.
I know. Yeah. I have a hard time necessarily. I don't know. This does feel like the grass is always greener a little bit, but I don't think it necessarily matters that much.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Next one, tabs versus spaces. Where are you at with that right now?
I am in tabs because I had a very convincing argument that tabs are more accessible, but there's like two people using my code base. So does it necessarily matter? I don't know, but I'm using tabs just because. Yeah.
The argument of tabs is that a tab is one character, and how that is displayed in your editor is up to the end user. That is an editor value, right? Mm-hmm. Like you could make a tab 1,000 pixels wide, or you could make a tab one space wide. It's up to you. It's just one tab. And that's actually a really good argument. And then the spaces spaces kind of comes back to where people were like, well, 2 spaces, 4 spaces. I use 2 spaces myself, only because I try to cram as much code as I can. Not cram, but when I'm coding, I don't like it when I have my code goes horizontally off the thing. I don't mind it when I'm coding, but when I'm doing videos, if it makes a horizontal scroll or it wraps, that's very annoying to people watching. So I'll try to do 2, but it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. I think with a lot of these, it doesn't really matter, but the next one does matter. Semicolons or no semicolons, Scott?
No semicolons. I don't know in what universe I would ever need a semicolon. I'm kind of passionate about this one. No, I don't care. The arguments against semicolons is there's like a 1% use case where a semicolon becomes important. But guess what?
Yeah.
In that use case, Prettier adds it for me or ESLint. I don't even know which one because I don't think about it. Because when I save the file, it automatically adds the semicolon in the one instance in which it needs it. And other than that, I just don't need them. I don't need them polluting my eyes.
A lot of the arguments that we used to have are now solved with, well, Prettier fixed that for us. So it's no longer an argument. It just fixes it for us. I do use semicolons all the time. I like them.
Big oof.
I like them. They're great. I can't code without them. I just like seeing them in there. And that's all I got for you on that one.
I really don't like seeing them in there. If I see them in there, it makes me upset. So funny that.
Oh man, that's good.
Next is let versus const. You know, I'm using const for everything unless it gets actually redefined, and then I will use let, but only because I'll start with const and then I'll say, oh wait, I actually need to change this variable. I'm going to use let. And that's mostly, again, that goes along really well with the functional style of programming for me. So yeah, I'm using const.
Yeah, I do const by default. And if I need to explicitly change a value, which is very rare because the situations where I would need a let is if you have a Boolean you need to flip. So I just use const, and that allows me not to ever have to overwrite like an object or anything like that, because with const, you still can change properties of an object. And in most cases, that's what I'm using. So default to const and then change to let when I need it. And never use var, not because var is deprecated or anything like that, but I just like the block scoping of let and const.
Yeah, that's really the way it is for me. Yeah.
Whereas var is function scoped, not block scoped. So anytime you have a set of curly brackets, you can think of them as a fence that are keeping your let and const values in, whereas var variables will leak outside. And that's kind of annoying for like for loops and whatnot.
What about for TypeScript? Do you explicitly type your things, or do you allow TypeScript to imply some types?
That's a good one.
I started out using the implied types quite a bit and just letting TypeScript do its magic. But I found some bit of comfort in just like explicitly typing everything.
Yeah, I can see what you mean by that, because it's very easy for something is implied based on something else and that something else is implied based on that. And then you change one thing and it could ripple through your code base without you seeing that. I will use, and I got this answer from asking a lot of people, is it okay to use implicit types? Implicit types for internal code, anything that is exported and used as an API or used as a function somewhere else in your code base should be explicitly typed. And I don't even know if there's like a lint rule that would say, if this value is exported, you must explicitly type it. Wouldn't that be kind of a cool linting rule?
That would be kind of a cool linting rule. Yeah. I think I'd like that.
So yeah, I think that's a good way to go about it, but you certainly can go a long way with implicit types in TypeScript. And it's very, very handy, especially if you are like, I don't know, you change the return type of a function, then you don't have to explicitly go and change it yourself. It's just implied, right? It can be very freeing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sometimes it's nice to, I mean, in terms of like catching bugs and stuff like that, always making sure that everything is explicitly typed for me has found some instances in which I thought something was implied to be something and it really wasn't, without me having to like hover my mouse over and being like, what is this implied to be? And the TypeScript will just complain.
That's true. That's a good point as well.
What about naming variables? So camel case, upper camel case, kebab case, snake case, screaming snake. Oftentimes you'll see people use screaming snake case for like constant variables and things like that. Do you have any specific rules? Are you doing one thing, everything one way or whatever?
In JavaScript, I will default to camel case. In CSS, I go between, it's per project, I go between kebab case, which is dashes, and camel case. For some reason, I tend to like the look of kebab case a little bit more in CSS and writing in HTML. I'm not sure why. And then I don't use snake case unless it's by convention. And that convention is often in GraphQL queries and mutation seems to be better. I don't know why, but uppercase with screaming snake case, that's all uppercase with underscores in it, seems to just be a convention for GraphQL mutations. And or like a Redux reducer will often be named like that as well. And for some reason, I like that convention because you look at it very quickly, you know exactly what that thing is.
Yeah, people use screaming case. The reason why that is that way, screaming snake for constants is really the way that people do it. So it's like you have like a, for your mutations or your actions or whatever, those are string constants typically, which is why you'll often see that way. So that's like one of the reasons why people do this. You know, Rich Harris posted a study saying why he uses snake case, showing that you're like your brain can perceive it faster. You can read it easier.
Interesting.
And I've started like going all in on snake case because of that. And you know, I'm just, you know, it's a svelte thing to do, right? But I started using snake case and I gotta say, I love it. I use snake case for everything now. I use snake case for CSS. I use snake case for everything except for components. And components, I do upper camel case. But everything else, snake case all the way, baby.
Yeah, snake case. Wow. You should get a snake case tattoo.
I know. That's... You know what? I like snake case even more because of the name of it. If it wasn't called snake case, I might not as be in it, as there, hard as I it, am.
We've talked about this before. There is a Wikipedia entry called Naming Conventions. Programming. We'll put that in the show notes for you. And it lists all the types. Snake case is also called pothole case.
No.
Camel case is also called dromedary. Dromedary case. What's a dromedary?
You might want to know before you...
Dromedary is also known as a dromedary camel, Arabian camel, or one-humped camel. Why would you call it drum? Maybe in flat case is all lowercase. Pascal case is underscores. Kebab case, train case is uppercase with a kebab in it. but screaming kebab case is also that. So there's some pretty fun. Oh, HTTP header case.
HTTP.
HTTP header case is dashes with capitals on every word, which makes sense because that's what headers are.
Hmm. Cases. Huh. Yeah.
Cases.
Yeah.
I think once a year we get into this. What are all these other things called? And it's a treat to look at it. It's kind of fun.
It is. It's a treat. Yeah. It's definitely a treat. Next one is looping for each versus for in, or just loops in general. And I almost find myself using array methods to do any kind of looping nowadays. And it's just because I've gotten so used to it. I'm so comfortable with it. I almost never reach for a classic for loop anymore unless, I don't know, when am I reaching for that? There are times, but it's like very much not often for me. I'm usually having an array and I'm doing something to that array and over the contents of that array. So that's why I'm using array method for each or map or anything, reduce, whatever. So I guess there aren't too many times where the code that I'm writing in my UI code or any of that stuff is having to essentially do something for X amount of times that's not based on an array length.
Yeah, yeah. I will default to using an array method, most likely for each, unless you actually need to modify the data. In that case, it's a map or a reduce. But I am a big proponent of the for in loop. Because the for in loop can be awaited inside of it. So if you have an asynchronous function that you need to do inside of that, you can wait. You can await inside of that and it will pause that loop from running. That's really nice. The for in loop will allow you to loop over objects and other iterables. The for in loop will allow you to skip an iteration with the continue word, and you can stop that loop from running entirely with a break clause. So those are the situations where you say, let me stop a second. And instead of using an array method here, let me reach for a for in method, or not a method, a for in loop.
Yeah, I think that's probably the times that I'm reaching for them specifically. It's like if I have to do anything like that, then I'll say, okay, let me pull out the old loop here.
Yeah, and same with if you want to loop over object.entries, and object.entries will give you an array, and each item in the array will be the key is the first item, and the value is the second item. And that's really nice because you can destructure that in a for in loop. I guess you can destructure that in a regular for each loop as well, though. Mm-hmm. But it's a really nice experience rather than having to do the, remember the square bracket I where you reference the index of it? That was a pain in the butt. It's much nicer to have proper variables.
Yeah, no thanks. Thanks. That street puts me back into a place of programming that I haven't done in a while, you know?
Yeah. For loops were a pain.
Yeah. For you naming next would be if statements with curlies. This one feels like even wrong for me to have on this list. Some people, I don't know who, but some people will put curly brackets on the line below their if statement. They'll say if condition. And I actually want to add another one onto this, which would be like an inline if statement, which you were typing that as I was thinking. Yeah. That. Wow. Okay. So here's what I don't do. I would never put an opening curly bracket on the line below the if statement.
Oh,
I would never do that.
You freaking go to jail if you do that.
You should go to jail if you do that. Yeah, I'll second that statement. But what about one-liner if statements, like where you say if conditional and then do the thing, where you can have an expression in there or you can assign a variable without curly brackets at all?
Yeah, there's no block needed.
I'll do this all day. I definitely like to do this. Yeah, I am a big fan of this because to me, it's very readable. And it's more readable than using a ternary. People will throw ternaries left and right. So instead of saying like const, or let's say you're saying you're reassigning a variable, you're saying thing is equal to and then a ternary conditional. That to me is less readable than if conditional thing is equal to whatever the condition should be. So to me, just having the word if there and the condition wrapped around there is way more readable. And I will opt into those one-liners because I just like that.
100%. Yeah, you nailed it there. Is that those one-liner if statements that you don't need the curly brackets for the one-liner, they read so nice rather than the double ampersand that people are like, what is this trick you're doing?
Short circuit
evaluation, I believe it's called.
Nullish coalescing.
Yeah, no thanks. Give me the if statement reads so nicely. I used to be the opposite camp because I used to follow Idiomatic JS. And they said, don't do a one line. Even if you want to do a one line, throw a set of curly brackets in there. Oh. And the reasoning against that was because someone could come along and say, okay, this is an if statement, but now I want to add another thing. So I'm going to put it on its own line. And bing, boom, boom, you broke your if statement because there's no curly brackets. But to that I say, I know how if statements work. Everybody who works on my code base knows how if statements work. I explain the gotcha in all of my programming courses, so that's fine. If you want to have two things that you do on the if statement, then just put curly brackets in there.
Yeah, can you imagine hitting an if statement without curly brackets, putting it on the next line and just being like, I don't know what to do here. Like, is that hard to add the curly brackets? I don't think it's that hard.
Yeah, exactly. Next one we have here is naming files. So you... Let's say you have a folder, let's say you have something called Format Money. Would you create a folder called Format Money and name that index.js, or would you just create a file called formatmoney.js? And then I guess the third option is, do you create a folder called Format Money and a file also called formatmoney.js?
Oh, that last one seems, a little rough to me.
That's what I do. I often will do that.
I would group it into a folder of like money utilities or something.
Yeah, I make a utils folder. That's what I do in most cases, actually.
The dumping ground that is the utils folder. Yeah.
Yeah.
This one is hard for me. You know, I kind of get the vibe sometimes that I have way too many files named index.ts or index.svelte. And that could be a huge pain. One thing I've done to relieve this pain, because sometimes you need it, like you're dealing with raw files or you just have a lot of index files in general. There's a property in VS Code in their settings called editor label format, which changes how the tab is displayed. And if you change that property from default to short, it will always show the folder that that file is in next to the file name. So for instance, I have a index.svelte file open right now, but it says index.svelte and then next to it, it says library. So I know that's the library route index file. And without that property, it would just say index.ts. I mean, I don't know what file am I working with here. I'd have to look at the breadcrumbs or something, right?
Yeah.
So this to me makes things just a little bit easier. Another thing that's nice-ish about having a lot of index files is when you do your fuzzy search inside of VS Code, your command prompt search, whatever that is, it finds them based on the folder title. So like if you just type in library, since I only have, I think, like an index file inside of library or whatever, it's going to pop in all the files inside of library. So it's not a huge pain, but it definitely can be a bit of a pain.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that setting you said is on by default, because if you have multiple files named the same thing, VS Code will clarify it. No, I must have turned it on.
The default functionality is that it only shows the folder if you have multiple files named index open. But sometimes you just have one index file open. And you want to know which folder that's in.
What's the setting called again? I need to turn that on right now.
Editor label format. And then the one I have it set to is short, which just means it's always on, basically.
Okay. I like that. I think I like that. Depends.
It doesn't take up too much to me. It is not too noisy, but yeah.
Interesting. So another way around this is you could just make an index file that export star from and then the name of the file, but then you're making two files for every file that you need to make. So I'm not sure if that's...
Do you know what that's called? It's called a barrel file. And you know what? I really loved barrel files. I like kind of went all in on barrel files. And then I hit some like big pain points where something was requiring something from a file that was then pulling in another module, breaking my code splitting or bringing in a module where it didn't have to. So yeah. It was like increasing my bundle sizes. And more importantly, I had like some shared, a shared monorepo folder, and I had a barrel file in that. So then I was trying to load server side code on the client side and vice versa. And I'm just like, you know what? I think I might be done with barrel files for a little bit here.
Last one we have here is inline testing versus running a test as a process. I'm going to need you to explain what you mean by this.
So I don't know if Vtest has this, but Jest has this where you can run the Jest extension. So that way when you're writing tests, it has like a little green or red.
Oh,
or
in your editor. Or
the test in your editor,
yes, versus I have having that on.
Running yeah. the test. You have that on?
I
don't like that.
Don't have it on right now. Sorry, I did. I turned it off. Okay. I don't know. I turned it off for, I often turn off extensions for recording a course and then I just never turn them on again.
I think that is something that I do as well. But yeah, I just don't like that. I don't like it. Yeah.
Interesting.
Why.
What do you
it's
like?
It's supposed to be easier, but oh, I like invoicing and I like making money. So I like FreshBooks.
FreshBooks is the cloud accounting software that will revolutionize your business. It's ridiculously easy to use. You simply sign up. You can go ahead and start creating all your clients in there. Every single time you have a new client, you create them in. You create a new invoice. You send it off to them. They can pay online. You can hook it up to all kinds of different ways to get paid. You can get them to send you a check in the mail, which unfortunately still happens quite a lot in Canada. But you can mark it as paid. That's one thing I would do is I would take the check to the bank, deposit it, and mark it as paid right there and then. So I didn't accidentally say, did I deposit that thing again? Especially if it was like a round number, like $1,000. You're like, forget which one that was. So you can do invoicing. You can do all of your expenses in there. You can turn expenses into invoices if it's related to a specific client. We talked about that, like with a flight. You can track your time. It's all in the cloud. The iPhone app is amazing. The Android app, I'm assuming, is amazing as well. Check it out, freshbooks.com/syntax. If you are a small business, freelancer, or whatever type of business, you are going to need this. Get a 30-day free trial. Thank you, FreshBooks, for sponsoring.
Sick. All right, CSS time. Cascading style sheets.
Yes, the first one. Property, when you have CSS, do you put a space between the property and the value? So if you say color:black or color:black, you put a space, right?
Space black. That sounds pretty space sweet. Black. That's true. I do. I put a space. Yeah. Gotta have that space.
Yeah, me too. I really need to get like a prettier for CSS up and running. I have it in a couple of projects, but that's just one of those things. Sometimes I forget it. And then you look at your code, you're like, that looks kind of messy. Mm-hmm. So I will.
Stylent or prettier. Yeah.
Yeah. Just prettier works on CSS, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I have StyleLint set up to do some auto fixing for me as well.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Next one is nesting. What's your approach for when you nest and when you don't? Or how nesting do you nest?
For me, has gotten less desirable the more I get more features for CSS scoping. We have a lot of new CSS features for scoping that aren't quite there yet. But even just like using Svelte's auto CSS scoping or installed components, this is, you know, it's a method of scoping, right? So the more I've gotten control over my own scope and it's not just one giant CSS file, the less I'm using nesting like crazy.
Yeah, I think you can get out of hand with nesting, and it doesn't allow you to reuse your styles as much as you possibly could when you don't nest. So generally, I'll nest at like a component level. It's kind of the same rules for a component with me. It's like I will nest something in a component, and as soon as I find that this thing is getting a little bit too big, that means mm-hmm. it should probably be put into its own component and into its own CSS selector. That's my approach there. Although I turned on the new CSS nesting syntax for one of my courses because I was like, even just doing simple examples, I'm like, I miss having nesting mm-hmm. in here if you're just using straight CSS. And the syntax is a little bit to get used to. We have a whole show on it, but I'm really excited to get it first citizen in the browser.
Yeah, the syntax isn't my favorite thing, but yeah, it's it's definitely good.
It's the same thing with like CSS variables. At first we were like, ooh, what's the dashes? And now I'm just like, whatever, sick dashes. I like it.
Yeah, CSS variables definitely turned me off initially. And then like once I realized that they were runtime, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is, I don't care about the syntax.
I have zero qualms about the syntax anymore. You know, it works for me and it makes sense. And it's easy to know. Maybe a dollar sign would have been nice, but dash dash works too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, totally.
What about alphabetizing your CSS properties? I think we've touched upon this a few times.
Yeah, I will occasionally do this. And it's like one of those things that I'm doing when I'm like bored. Like I'll just alphabetize my, you know, I had a rule that auto did it on save and it like stopped working at some point and I just haven't touched it. So this is something that I like because it helps me find properties really quickly. I'm never like writing CSS in a way that that would cause any sort of functional issues. So for me, I do like to have them alphabetized, but I'm not intense enough to the point where if my thing broke and it stopped doing it, am I going to take the time out of my day to fix it? It's going to be those ones where I'm like, meh, okay, whatever.
I don't alphabetize mine. I generally group them loosely together by things like layout, grid and flex, positioning. Positioning, it includes margin, padding, top left, bottom left, top right, bottom, TR, bottom left. Yes. Text properties. So just kind of group them loosely together so that when I want to change something about the padding or the grid layout, then it's not, I'm not hunting up and down, especially with grid where you might have three or four different properties on a single selector defining how that thing is gridded out.
Next will be rems, ems, pixels, etc. You know what? I'm straight up using pixels for most things. Unless it's like viewport units. I'm pretty much almost always using pixels nowadays. Yeah. There are times when I want to get into relative units, and I think ems and rems work fine for that. In that point, I'm typically using rems because I want it to be relative to the viewport. But that's really it. Now that it feels like pixel, there's like no downside to using pixels besides the fact that they're, you know, explicitly coded to me. I don't have a problem with pixels.
Yeah, it's funny because people are always like only rems 100%. And then you see them do this like calculation in their head where they're like, I want it to be 15 pixels. So 1.5 rems, you know, and it's just like, you're just calculating the pixels in your head instead of writing it into the things. And I get it because you can scale the entire document up and down by changing the base, but you can also do that with your command plus button as well pretty easily, right? So I guess if you needed to programmatically scale the website up without the user having any interaction, maybe a selector for font size or something like that, you could do that. I generally still do default to rems or pixels. Every now and then I find a use case for ems where like if you want an entire component to scale up, but I find myself saying, instead of doing the ems dance where everything is like as soon as you nest sizes in ems world, they multiply by each other and then it's game over. And you should say, well, don't do that. And that's the actual answer to that. But I find it easier just to set a variable of the base size. And if you want to change the size, then crank that variable up and every other thing is calculated based off that with CSS calc.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Good. Yeah, I feel like the rems people, rems are very, very good, but I feel like the always rems all the time, people are missing it a little bit.
It feels like, you're always kind of translating it to something else to understand.
Yeah.
What about centering in CSS? It depends on what I'm centering. If I'm centering a position fixed, I'm using the new inset property. If I am centering something, in Flexbox, I'll use a flex container. If I'm centering something generally, I would say I use a flex container and then do.
That's what I was wondering.
Justify content center.
Someone says, put this thing in the middle of the screen. What do you reach for?
Usually probably Flexbox.
Okay. Yeah,
or Grid.
Yeah.
But probably Flexbox.
I reach for Flex. If it's just pop this thing in the exact middle, I reach for Flexbox because you can do that in the least amount of properties and the quickest possible way with Flexbox. But sometimes I will throw a Grid in there as well. I think there's a shorthand now. Place items. Yeah. Place items will do your justify and your align in one property. So you can say display grid, justify item, center. And so that's two lines, the same as Flex as well. But it really doesn't matter in that. I feel like, I don't know if it's because Flex is first, but that's like, I remember when Flexbox came, you're like, oh my gosh, finally we can center something in CSS. I still make use of margin zero auto. If I just want to horizontally center something. And text align center, those things are pretty good. No more center tag though, but that's it.
Yeah, not only do that, I do that, but I'll use margin left and right auto without using margin left and right auto, you know, just to float something over to the side. So
awesome. How do you make something 100% height? So you got a blank HTML document and someone says, put this box of unknown width and height in the middle of the screen.
This is so frustrating. I use one of the 800 new viewport units. No, but I'm typically using a viewport unit. Yeah.
I'm putting a
viewport unit. And then if it's something that is a critical for mobile to be perfect, then I'll do the whole calculations of the status bar and all that stuff. And maybe have to get into some JavaScript. But, you know, for the most part, it's like just straight up VH100.
Yeah, I put a min height 100 VH on the body in the HTML tag. HTML tag will snap because of the body. And then sometimes I'll cheat and put a display flex right on the body. And I always regret that. Mm-hmm. So I throw a wrapper in there and then put the item in there.
I'm right there with you on that. Yeah. I know there's like something really intriguing about doing that because it's kind of a little bit more like how React Native does their layouts. It's like everything's flex based. So I got used to doing everything vertically in a flex like column or flex rows or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And flex axis.
Yeah. Flex direction columns, rows, whatever. And yeah, I do regret it every single time I do it. I hear you on that. Let's actually take a quick break to talk about one of our sponsors today, which is Sentry at sentry.io. It's the perfect place to see all of your errors and exceptions happen in a really nice interface, a nice way to see who's at fault for what, but not necessarily who's at fault, but who did the thing so that you know who to go to maybe get it patched up or fixed, or you can see how important something is by how many users it's affecting. You push this thing out, it's affecting 10,000 users in 10 minutes, you might be thinking, oh no, I did something wrong. And this allows you to see all that in a great interface. So Sentry is an amazing tool for tracking exactly how your site is performing at any given time, whether that is performance or errors and exceptions. Head on over to sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and you'll get 2 months for free. Thanks so much for Sentry for sponsoring.
Next one is comments. This is a big thing. I always get this comment on Twitter. Code should be self-documenting. If you write code properly, you don't even need comments. What do you agree with that, Scott?
No, I don't. I straight up comments are not just, you know, here's a function named get tutorials. And then you write a comment that says this function gets the tutorials. That's not like what comments are necessarily there to do. Like, sure, that code is self-documenting. But, you know, a lot of times the code that we write has more involvement in it than just, oh, it goes off and does this thing. There's sometimes implementation details or little things that are very specific to why we need to do things certain ways. Or maybe we're doing something and it would look to somebody who's doing a code review to be odd, but you have to do it that way for a specific reason. Like, I swear, I'm only on my Braintree integration here, I'm only setting the date that they're canceled to be one more month past their current one because Braintree doesn't have a method to do that for me. You know, it's like, this is why I'm doing all this extra stuff. And sometimes comments are just there to make it easier for everyone to help them understand. So yeah, I use comments. I like writing comments. It helps me, my type of brain, get a handle on something a little bit faster.
Yeah, I agree. I think with TypeScript, Everything is a little bit more self-documented because you can literally follow the trail. But I put lots of comments in my code base, and especially for future Wes, I always thank myself for explaining, mm-hmm. like, why did you do it this way instead of this way? Because of the X, Y, and Z implementation details. And you could also put that in a test as well, but nothing beats just having a little bit of a comment so someone can get context for why something is done a certain way right inside of it.
Yeah. And I also curse myself when I don't leave good comments. there's actually an extension I think we both use called Better Comments. Do you have any conventions for Better Comments? Because by default, the exclamation point makes it red, which I will be using for, you know, caution, danger ahead, or maybe like a question mark for here's how this thing works, or an asterisk for just general notes about something. But I do make use of Better Comments and their associated glyphs.
Yes, I wrote a custom parser for it once. And because in my courses, I often will have code and say, this is the solution. And I wanted to like highlight the solution comment differently than the rest. Here, let me send you a little message on Slack with the link here, Scott. And okay. I will link a screenshot to this in the show notes. I use to do the most. And every now and then I have the question and whatnot. But I said anything that starts with solution, put a yellow background on it. And then anything that is a task, like I say task one, task two, task three, that I don't like when that blends in with the rest of the comments of the course, because somebody is doing the course, they want to be able to see what it is. So I made a custom parser for it. And I believe I can ship that with my courses in the VS Code folder and provide a bit more of a better experience when viewing a JavaScript file.
A bit more of a better comments experience?
A bit, yeah.
I love it.
Best what about comments?
To-dos. I use an extension called To-Do Tree that has support for several different types of to-dos, and then we'll put them all into a tree where you can see all of your to-dos at a glance. And it has support for additional things like capital bug or hack or fix me or triple X for some reason. I don't know when exactly that would come into play in your code base, but it's nice. I use these all the time. I use the bug hacks and fix me way less than I use the to do, but I do use to do's and I sprinkle them throughout my code base because you know what? It's a nice thing to have them in there and then you can see it later or you can find them or you can use to do tree and have it point them out to you. I know to do's are one of those things where I made a video about to do tree on YouTube and like half the comments were like, you should have never used to do's. I was like, I don't know. They're fine to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I like them as well. People are like, well, if you're putting a to-do in there, that you should be logging that into like a bug tracker or whatever. And I said,
sure, whatever.
To that I say, I just want to put a to-do in there and never actually to do it.
Yeah. Right. It's an intention. It's not necessarily an actual to-do. It makes me feel like I did it. And that's okay too.
Next one is, I don't know if necessarily you know you have a thought on this, but if you want to loop over a bunch of data and create some HTML. Let's say you have an array of dogs' names and you want to display them as list items in a UL. Mm-hmm. How would you turn that from JavaScript data into HTML?
Yeah, I think there's an actual more performant answer for this. Let me pull up. I did a little bit of a deep dive into this at one point. So the difference between like HTML as a string and then using like create element. And so typing HTML as a string is apparently much slower because it requires a reparsing of the text, right? You're parsing that text into HTML elements. So it's kind of having to do double duty. From what I don't know practically what this turns out to be, but from what I have read, HTML as a string is worse performance.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Whether that actually is a big deal or not is depends on like how much are you doing it 1,000 times a second or are you doing it once to populate it, you know? Yeah. Generally what I'll do is I will use backticks and render it out unless a few things. One, is there a possibility of user data?
Input.
Meaning that is the data's name going to be alert you got hacked? Because then that's an XSS vulnerability and you probably shouldn't be doing that. Or is there, do you need to attach an event listener before or after you've injected that into the DOM? If that's the case, then I'll use document.createElement and document.append or element.appendChild and all those APIs. Mm. And then there's even a new API now. It's called the DOM Parser API. I'm not sure how new it is, in the last few years. And the DOM Parser API will allow you to, it's kind of best of both worlds. You can take your string of HTML, which is very easy to make, and then the DOM Parser API will just convert that to DOM elements, and then you can dump that sucker in the DOM whenever it is that you need it. DOM parser.parse from string.
Dump that sucker in the DOM. Dump that. Dump.
DOM parser. Parse
in the DOM.
Yeah, it's DOM parser.parse from string, which will take your string and turn it into an actual DOM element, which is also handy if you, like, ideally you're not appending to the DOM many times. Ideally you're doing it once. That's where you get the perf. But that will allow you to, if you need to do complex stuff with the DOM before it's actually in the DOM, you can do it. I feel like I said DOM too much.
DOM. Okay. What about like components? We have React, Components, Svelte, Vue, whatever. Do you prefer to create and work on your components in isolation or within your application?
Almost always inside the app. I definitely see the benefit of using like Storybook or something like that to create them in isolation. But generally, I'm just going for it, building an app out. When it comes to making them reusable, then it's probably a good time to, especially with styling, to take them and put them in their own isolation. What about you? Do you do it all from isolation?
No, I do it mostly in app. I started working on my own isolation tool. And I find that there's some really fun things about working in isolation. It can be really fast. It can be really illuminating. So like, for instance, I had an icon component and it allowed me to essentially display all of the different icons at once. Like, just give me a map or a loop over all of my different icons and to display them each within isolation, right? And that allowed me to see like discrepancies between my various icons. So I had said that some icons that weren't getting the color property, some icons that weren't getting past the stroke property correctly, or some that weren't getting their height assigned. So like it allowed me to see really quickly some discrepancies in how I was building things. And so I like it in isolation. My tool has currently hit a bit of a snag in that like I would really love to have it be rendered within an iframe. And there's like definitely some issues with rendering things in an iframe where the strategy I'm trying to do is basically portal the rendering of a Svelte component into an iframe, which kind of works, but then like state updates are difficult. And then so I went down the whole track of like then implementing this Svelte REPL into my project. And then it was like, oh no, wait, now I have to worry about TypeScript. And now I have to worry about this and that. I'm like, this is too much. I'm just going to go ahead and not use it as an iframe anymore and wait till element queries are here. So that's pretty much it. I do like working in isolation, but I don't primarily.
Yeah. Let's talk about one of our sponsors, which is Sanity. Sanity is the unified content platform that powers digital experiences. So that means that Sanity will allow you to store all of the data for your website or for your application inside of Sanity. And then they also have this thing called Sanity Studio, which is the CMS editing UI. And they are just releasing, it's currently in beta, it's coming out pretty soon, the ability, like the Sanity Studio is a React application, and you run that, you can run and host that React application anywhere you want, and it just talks Sanity via the APIs. Now they're rolling out the ability to integrate that thing into your existing React applications without a custom build tool. You can customize the UI. Pretty cool, because I can see some really neat stuff with, they have all this like real-time preview editing. They have all these great workflow experiences with it. I've used it in my courses. I've used it myself. It's great. But I think integrating into an existing React application without a separate build step or keeping it separate is going to be a game changer. So you want to check it out, sanity.io/syntax. That will get you double the free usage share. Thank you, Sanity, for sponsoring.
Sick. Cool. Okay. let's talk about single file, single component per file. And in addition to that, single file components, which this is something that I've definitely, since moving into the Svelte world, single file components, to me, it's where it's at, where you can have a CSS, HTML, and JavaScript just within one file and not have to worry about anything else. I think the Svelte way of doing it is really nice. It's also the Vue.js way of doing it, also really nice. And I used to, in the React world, I used to have occasionally multiple components per file, and I kind of regret doing that. I mean, I don't regret that I did it, but I just don't, like, thinking back on it, I'm like, yeah, did I really need to do that? I guess with React, it's a little bit different because you end up having to do, like, really obnoxious wrapping components or things like that, maybe higher order components to wrap something, and it's just not worth it putting that in its own file. But I almost never do that in the Svelte world, and that feels really nice to me.
Yeah, I agree. I like the single component versus multiple as well. I do have that in React as well, where you can, I will default to putting it all in one file, my styles, my logic, and my display. And then as it gets either shared amongst multiple files or becomes a little bit overwhelming for one file, I will factor it out back into its, into their own separate files.
Mm-hmm.
What next one we have here is naming components. What's your process for naming a component?
I do a capital, what is it? Capital camel. And then I'll typically name things. And it depends. If something is like kind of a subcomponent of something, like accordion header versus the accordion, accordion tab, accordion body, or whatever, right? I am occasionally scoping by name, but I do like to think about components in a less scoped manner. And I'm not trying to create components that are that tightly scoped. I'm trying to get a little bit more reusable. But sometimes you do have like scoped components where this thing really only makes sense as a child of something else. And then if it is like a tightly scoped component, I'll do the naming convention where it's almost like BEM style, where you'll have like the block object modifier or whatever this thing is, where this is like the parent of it. And then this is what it is. So that's typically how I'm doing it. The last one is just going to be some general stuff. Extra lines and spacing. Do you ever add additional lines of code? Sometimes I add additional lines of code, or like just empty lines, to give myself some breathing room. And then we'll get annoyed when Prettier removes them for me.
I do exactly the same thing. As I used to usually to do like two lines in between every single one of my functions, just for readability. I find increasing the line height in your editor helps with that a little bit. But now that I have Prettier, it's not one of those things that I necessarily think about. If anything, I'll have to do like a multi-line comment just to space it down a little bit more.
I'll do that explicitly to remove some of those. Because it is some of those, you know, sometimes I just straight up want a little bit of breathing room. So I will add a multi-line comment to give myself some of that space just to breathe a little bit. What about magic? What kind of magic do you like?
Magic versus no magic. And what I mean by this is that sometimes you use a framework or a library where it just works. It's just magic. It's just behind the scenes. Svelte is a good example of that, where you just write your code in it and it binds it all. You can do mutations. You can edit a variable directly and they will just update wherever you use it, right? And then there's no magic, where things are a little bit more explicit, but you know how everything works. And there's people on both sides of the camp. I'm certainly in the more magic, as long as it doesn't restrict me from doing anything or cause me major performance issues. So I am on team magic.
Yeah, I'm kind of on team magic too. Yeah. Life's too short for me right now to have to explicitly define everything. Like, I remember getting into like Backbone and Marionette, and it was after I had worked in Angular 1. And I just was thinking like, man, this sucks. I got to like do every step of everything. And then when we moved from Angular 1 to React, I definitely felt some of that again. Like, why do I have to do this?
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. But yeah, that's just how it goes. Yeah, you go back and forth. I think that's like kind of natural ebb and flow of programming. You get a little bit, you feel the control that you get with less magic, and then you feel overburdened by it sometimes. And then you
boilerplate, yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that is our coding styles. Hopefully you enjoyed a thing or two of that. We'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these. Tweet us at SyntaxFM Always love hearing everybody's tweets from what they thought about the different things we talked about. We will quickly do some sick picks and wrap her up. Do you have a sick pick for me today?
Sick pick? I do have a sick pick. You know what? I got an iPad case for Landon. We had an old iPad and I provisioned it to be a child account on the iPad, which is something I didn't even know you could do. So I made Landon his own iPad account. And then I went to town on the iPad settings. So it's locked down. He can't install anything without it sending a message to my phone, asking if he's allowed to. So it's actually really neat, but we got him a case for it and it's been really nice because this is a handle and a stand case. There's some things that kids always want to do on the iPad and they want to carry it with them. They want to stand it up on the counter and you want to protect it from being dropped. So I think this thing does a really good job at all of those. It's got a big old handle and it's fun. It's a fun little case for him without being too over the top little kitty. You know, it's not it looks like a kid's iPad case, but it's not crazy babyish. Yeah.
My sick pick is going to be a garbage pick. And that is a garbage can. So we're moving out of our house. And there's a lot of things that we bought when we moved in 8 years ago. And there's a lot of things where I go to my wife, hey, this thing has been decent. Hey. And that was our garbage can. A simple human step on regular, round can step on. I think
we have this one.
And it's 8 years of daily use. And my favorite thing about it, and this is not usually something you hear about me, is there is proprietary bags for it, custom fit. And I was talking to Kayla and I was like, there's not much I'm proud of in my life, but being able to buy custom fit garbage bags, as a kid, my mom would just put the shopping bag in there and it would never fit properly and it would fall in. And you know how much a pain that is? So these ones, they have 80 different kinds of bags and you have to buy the custom bag. And they're not that much more expensive than just your regular Glad bags, but man, is it worth it when the bag fits extremely or fits nice and tightly. So we have a simple human garbage can and it is awesome.
Well, that's fun.
But now I'm looking at the ones where you wave your hand and it automatically opens for you.
That sounds like a nightmare. That sounds like an absolute nightmare.
There's ones that you have to you can say open can and it opens for you. And I was sitting there being like, there's no way that's any good. That's probably garbage.
Open. we have one that's built into our cabinets that you just pull out a drawer.
Oh yeah. We're hoping that we bought our house and we didn't look through all the drawers. So now we're just looking at photos being where's the garbage can? So we'll find that out this week.
We actually were using our Simple Humans one in the kitchen. And it was Courtney's mom was staying with us. She's like, why aren't you using the pull-out drawer one? And we're just using it for recycling. We were only using it for recycling. And we're like, yeah, maybe we should just use it for the trash. Then we don't have to have this trash can hanging out here.
Yeah.
And it has been a big upgrade.
It's a good life. Good life. Cool.
It's a good life. Yeah.
Shameless plugs, westboss.com/courses lists all the programming courses that I offer. If you'd like to buy one, they are $10 off with coupon code Syntax, or there's lots of free ones on there as well.
Sick. I would like to shamelessly plug Level Up Tutorials summer sale at levelup.com. Until the end of the week, as in the time you're listening to this until Friday, we are 50% off the pro subscription, and that will lock you into that price until the subscription is complete, until you cancel it, right? So you can sign up today and then hold on to that price for as long as you want, as long as you resubscribe, and you'll get access to over 128 courses. And that's right. Each of these courses has about 27 videos in them. So you get access to a massive amount of content, all at 50% off. So head on over to leveluptutorials.com and sign up to become a pro at the cheapest price that you'll be able to get ever.
All right. Thank you for tuning in. We will catch you on Friday.
Peace. Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.